Death is nothing at all. It does not count. I have only slipped away into the next room. Nothing has happened. Everything remains exactly as it was. I am I, and you are you. And the old life that we lived so fondly together is untouched, unchanged. Whatever we were to each other, that we are still. Call me by my old familiar name. Speak of me in the easy way which you always used. Put no difference into your tone. Wear no forced air of solemnity or sorrow. Laugh as we always laughed, at the little jokes that we enjoyed together. Play, smile, think of me, pray for me. Let my name be ever the household word that it always was. Let it be spoken without an effort, without the ghost of a shadow upon it. Life means all that it ever meant. It is the same as it ever was. There is absolute and unbroken continuity. What is this death but a negligible accident? Why should I be out of mind because I am out of sight? I am but waiting for you, for an interval, somewhere very near, just round the corner. All is well. Nothing is hurt, nothing is lost. One brief moment, and all will be as it was before. How we shall laugh at the trouble of parting when we meet again. Some of us will know those words from funeral services or from cards sent at times of bereavement. Written by Henry Scott Holland as part of a sermon following the death of Edward VII, it was part of a much longer sermon in which Holland explored the consequences of death for those who live. While I know this poem brings comfort to many people, out of the context of the sermon, it can almost trivialise the real, raw feel of grief. And yet, read within Holland's sermon, it brings depth to the task of facing an alternative future without a friend or companion who brought depth, shape, and meaning to our encounters with the world. Holland speaks of our unchangeable relationship with the person who has died and the continuity of the certainty of that love, while acknowledging for those who are grieving, their life, not the relationship, will be changed. What comes through Scott Holland's sermon is a real recognition for those who are grieving that there can be no preparation for how we might feel in the time after someone we love has gone. It's an interesting thought as we live in a time when medicine has allowed us an insight into when death might stalk our doors. And we may well be aware of those who, once being faced with the news of a terminal diagnosis, prepare bucket lists of what they might achieve prior to death. The Guardian newspaper a fortnight ago carried an article entitled "London Bridge is Down, the Secret Plan for the Days After the Queen's Death," which shared one of the many scenarios that has been planned if and when this occasion occurs. And while we may not have a terminal diagnosis, and we may not be the Queen, there are, for those among us, people who have prepared for their deaths. I know there are people here who have hymns and music and readings already chosen. Some will have written their wills or at least made clear the financial implications for those we leave behind. But for those who are left behind, there is no preparation for what comes after. There is no way of preparing for absence. Instead, we live with the knowledge that the grief we will bear will come in an unexpected form. Each experience will be different, one from the other, whether that be between people or between our own experiences of death. I'm going to say at this point, I think we also experience grief in things other than relationships. And I'll come back to that later. I'm not sure that we will have ever thought of a story of the raising of Lazarus as an opportunity to explore the emotion of the absence in grief. And yet, what plays through the story to the moment of the miraculous is the differing personalities coming to a resolution with a death. Mary and Martha, as Lazarus's sisters, had seen the signs of Lazarus's death. They could see the slow changing pallor of someone desperately ill. They'd noticed the change in the pattern of breathing, the reluctance to eat and drink, the struggle to talk. In their preparations for his death, they send for one of their closest friends to come and be with them. Jesus had been to their house many times. He'd used it as a place away from the crowds. He'd taught Martha to relax and wonder and enjoyed Mary's sense of worship in his presence. As the story we hear this morning begins, John even adds the detail of a story that's still to happen, that Mary is the one who will wash Jesus' feet with perfume. All these are signs of intimacy and understanding. Mary and Martha want Jesus to come to share these last moments together, to bear the grief together, hoping that Jesus with them might mean that the inevitable never happens. Instead, Jesus sees no hurry. In Jesus' response, there's a play between the humanity of Jesus and his divinity. We could see the delaying through the words where Jesus suggests that to wait affords him the opportunity of greater glory. We could see that divinity. We could only notice that. Or we could see the humanity of Jesus as he struggles with the loss of this friend, delaying going back, delaying the experience of grief. On his arrival in Bethany, Jesus is met by Martha, who with the death of her brother has become the host within the house. We sense the tension of their meeting as Martha's accusatory tone hits him. He should have been there. This wouldn't have happened. You can change this. And he asks her to trust him. At the centre of this gospel, in the middle verse of the middle chapter of this gospel, one of those who would be marginalised by her world recognises the place she has at the heart of God when she declares her faith in the man who is her teacher and friend, and the one through whom God has revealed a presence. And from that high, we then walk into the wall of the grief of the story. Mary hears that Jesus is there, and she leaves the house, and as she meets Jesus, she falls at his feet, and her accusation at him not being there rings as she then weeps. For a moment, there is silence. No words. Jesus has no apology to offer. Instead, two words describe his presence. Jesus wept. In these words, we again catch sight of Jesus' humanity. He's not prepared for how the grief would impact upon him. He didn't expect the anger of the sisters. He didn't know how his heart would feel as it tore as he watched two people he loved struggle with the pain. He hadn't thought about how it would feel to return to the place where he had enjoyed the friendship of Lazarus. And again, there is silence. This time, Jesus makes his way to the tomb and in a prayer asks for the stone to be rolled away. And using the words of creation, for that's what the words that command come out are. They're like the words, let there be light. They're words of creation, words that transform the earthly. He calls for Lazarus to come to life and to be freed of the encasement of earth. We finish there, but the story transitions quickly at that point to reports of events to the Pharisees and their response. But there's no response from the sisters, from the crowd, or from Lazarus at this point in the story. We don't find out how they feel about these events. We don't know what they do immediately after. We're given no glimpse of post-resurrection life. We're only offered an experience of resurrection, the experience of overwhelming grief, the silence of being bereft of God, only to find God calling us from all that encases us from living in the light of the world. I said earlier in the last service that I struggle when it comes to telling a personal story, because I feel that when you tell a personal story, that changes the sermon from being about God to being about you, and a sermon should always be about God. The other reason I struggle with a story, particularly when it comes to grief, is I in no way want to belittle anybody's grief, but instead to say that grief comes in a myriad forms and in myriad ways. I have experienced grief in the loss of grandparents, and some of those losses are deeply felt and deeply borne. But actually, my biggest feeling of grief happened in the weeks after Keith and I were married. In the week that we got married, I was rushed into hospital with a number of pulmonary embolisms and a very large DVT, and ended up being absolutely hospitalised with drugs going through me. And on the Tuesday, as they discovered how bad it was, the consultant said to my parents with me in the room, I would cancel the wedding because she's not going to be there. Now, you can hear those words in two ways, and you can probably guess that I heard them probably in the more positive way at that point. My mother took the consultant aside to discover that perhaps my positive understanding wasn't the correct one, and that the more drastic one was. As you can see, I survived, and on the Saturday morning at 9:30, I was released from hospital with drugs to go and get ready for a wedding. I went to the wedding, and on the Sunday morning at 8:00, Keith and I had to be back in the hospital in case they had to readmit me. In the days that followed, immediately after the wedding, the fun of being married was there. We couldn't go on honeymoon because I wasn't allowed far away from the hospital. And then Keith went back to work, but I wasn't allowed to go back to my holiday job because I was receiving so much treatment and required to be in the hospital so often. And it wasn't very long before, in a new house and a new place and unable to meet with people, that I fell into what I was then to discover was a depression, but at the time I didn't know. Instead, at night, and I have to, often thank Keith for bearing with me, at night I would sit on the stairs absolutely distraught in tears, unable to see a way forward as I started to grieve for the life I thought we would have once we were married. I am very fortunate that I had a fantastic lecturer at New College who worked out fairly quickly what was going on with me when I returned to that term. And he, during that term, put me in a placement with somebody who was able to supervise me for my placement, but also able to counsel me through what was grief and depression. Out of that, I can quite clearly say that I, looking back, can see moments of resurrection. As you can see, the grief is sometimes still quite raw. It still hurts. There are bits of the life that we thought we would have that haven't happened. There are other bits that have surprisingly happened after we were told that they weren't. But as I said, I tell that story not to focus on me, but to say that grief comes in its myriad forms, and we can always be surprised by resurrection, and we can always be surprised by how resurrection comes and goes. There's no one clear pattern. Grief is a deeply personal experience. What we experience, how we experience, why we experience, the length, the waves, affect each individual differently. The story of Lazarus offers the hope that our emotions, whatever they are not wrong. It's okay to be accusatory. It's fine to be angry, fall down and hit the floor, rage at the silence. For in these emotions, Jesus walks towards us. And in moments of intimacy, he shares the tears we weep as we share together the stories of the ones we've lost, of the lives we've lost, of the way we wanted to be and loved so much. When our grief threatens to entomb us, to keep us from living, it's Jesus' voice that's calling to us in the friends, in the moments, in the opportunities, calling us out of the darkness, offering us hope, and calling us to a resurrection. Resurrection might not happen once, it may happen many times. Maybe we're not told what happened to those who witnessed Lazarus' resurrection for a reason. The door is left open to allow for as many new ways to live as there are ways to grieve. But the important part of the story is not us. The important part of the story is the presence of Christ found within us. Amen.